Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 1st of June. The 1st of June it is. Happy summertime. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about Reince Priebus and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Our first guest has written really a very, and it's on our Facebook page, I think it's worth reading, a really top-notch article on Reince Priebus that is in Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg Politics. It's on our Facebook page. He writes, our guest, when Donald Trump wrapped up the Republican presidential nomination on May 3rd by winning Indiana and forcing Cruz from the race, it fell on Reince Priebus to formally surrender on behalf of a shell-shocked party establishment. Priebus did so in a tweet. Donald Trump will be presumptive, spelled P-R-E-S-U-M-T-I-V-E. GOP nominee, we all need to unite and focus on defeating Hillary Clinton. The misspelling, our guest writes, either in homage to Trump's haphazard Twitter style or the latest example of a Republican Party that can't seem to get anything right. Reince Priebus has devoted 5 years, hundreds of millions of dollars in every ounce of his energy to pushing the party in another direction. It's a very thorough article. Our guest had a chance to spend a lot of time with Reince Priebus and also with Donald Trump. And he is Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. He was a senior editor at The Atlantic for a number of years, a Washington Monthly editor. He's written for The New Yorker, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. And he began his career at The Onion. Later in this hour, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is facing a challenge as well, and she is being challenged mostly by Bernie Sanders supporters who feel that she has been in Clinton's pocket for a long time and that it's time for a change at the DNC. And joining us the second half of this hour will be Alex Rorty, senior political writer for Roll Call. We'll be welcoming phone calls for the whole hour. It should be a really interesting hour. Feel free to join us whenever you'd like. And that's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Josh, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Wonderful article. It really is good. It's really good. And I read a lot of articles, but it's so informative. So here you got poor Reince Priebus. You know, I can't get this image out of my head of his listening to Newt Gingrich speeches when he was a teenager in Kenosha. Not something you normally do. But he's worked so hard to do this postmortem on why the Republicans lost in 2012, done this very extensive analysis of what they needed to do, reach out to minority voters and women and millennials, and then you get Donald Trump. It's just incredible, all he's worked for all these years.
Well, it is, and the irony, though, is that as party chairman, he doesn't get to choose the nominee. He gets stuck with a nominee, and his job at the RNC is to get that person elected. So the irony of the tension in the piece is that, this five-year effort that Priebus and the RNC and a lot of reform-minded Republicans have made to broaden the party's appeal enough to win the White House again, they've wound up being saddled with a nominee who is sort of a walking exaggeration of all the tendencies that have tended to drive away, immigrants, non-white voters, young people, gay people, women. And so it makes what should be a much easier election much more difficult for the Republicans.
Did you ask him why he didn't resign his position?
And he said that he is now the longest serving Republican chairman in party history. He came in at a point when the party was at a low ebb. Remember after Obama was elected in 2008, Democrats controlled the White House, the House, and the Senate. And since that period, Republicans have gradually and painstakingly taken control of most of the state houses in the country, the House, now the Senate.
Right.
And needed only the White House. So Priebus, in one sense, has presided over a historic Republican restoration and needed only to win the White House in order for Republicans to take complete control of Washington. So I think that he looked at that and the 5 years he spent trying to build the party back up and just wasn't ready to throw in the towel and walk away and saying, you know, I can't accept Trump. And so like a lot of Republicans, I think if you dosed Priebus with truth serum, he would tell you that Trump was not his first, second, or third choice. But he has made peace with the fact that Republican voters want Trump. That's who they've got to get. And if the Republicans are going to take back the White House, the vehicle for doing that is going to have to be Donald Trump.
So you have this major report where they did this. What went wrong? What do we need to do? One of the sentences, we must embrace and champion comprehensive immigration reform. If we do not, our party's appeal will continue to shrink to its core constituencies only. And I have heard, Josh, people say that they can't possibly win the White House, particularly after 2020, unless they reach out to that Hispanic vote in this country. It's lost to them. Do you think it is lost unless they reach out and follow their autopsy?
Well, what we know is happening is that there are a set of demographic trends in America where the groups that are growing, Hispanics, Asians, young people, women, all tend to be Democratic-leaning groups. And so if you're the Republican Party, you're gradually being strangled by these demographic trends. Now, this isn't kind of, you know, deep insight or political strategy. This is just basic numbers, and everybody knows this. One reason Republicans were so surprised that Obama won re-election was, you know, the economy wasn't doing terrific, Obama's numbers weren't terrific, and yet he was the beneficiary of this demographic wave. Every cycle, every presidential cycle, the electorate is about 2% more minority, 2% less white. And so what that means is eventually you're not going to be able to cobble together an electoral majority if you can't seriously begin to win over these non-white voters. And Republicans, after Mitt Romney's loss, I think did a lot of soul searching and introspection and realized that having your nominee say that immigrants ought to self-deport, and this was contained in the RNC's autopsy, that when you tell people that, they essentially, if they're immigrants, if they're sympathetic to immigrants, if they know immigrants, they at that point tune you out and you can't win them over.
Mm-hmm.
And so right after the election, this seems like a million years ago, but there was a fairly strong consensus in the GOP elite, including Fox News hosts like Sean Hannity and conservative writers like Charles Krauthammer, that the best thing Republicans could do was bite the bullet, pass comprehensive immigration reform, and then be able to win over some of these Hispanic voters. And as we know, that hasn't happened. And not only has that not happened, but Republicans have sort of pivoted off in the other direction.
Right. Well, you talked to Trump, and he said, and I'm quoting what you quoted, I'm above Mitt Romney with Hispanics. He was at 27%, and I, Donald Trump, am at 29%. I think I'm going to do great in Washington, Oregon, New Mexico, Florida, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Connecticut, and California. Does he really believe he's going to do well with Hispanics? Is he above Mitt Romney?
Well, he's above Mitt Romney in one poll, but remember, Romney only got 27%, which is historically low for Republicans. So Trump polling at 29% is sort of a tallest midget situation. Terrific, you're above Romney, but 29% with Hispanics is still a really, really bad number that is not going to get a Republican to the White House.
Mm-hmm. And what did Trump have to say about Reince Priebus when you talked to him about Priebus actually being rather condescending toward Trump?
Well, Priebus has been an interesting character vis-a-vis Trump. You know, 2 months ago, when it looked as if there was going to be a contested convention, and a lot of people thought that Cruz would win on the second or third ballot, Trump was furious, and he was furious at Republican leaders like Priebus, who he accused of having kind of rigged the election in a way that was meant to steal the nomination from him. As we all know, Trump beat Cruz pretty soundly. Cruz has dropped out. Trump is now the nominee, and Trump has changed his tune vis-a-vis Priebus. He now calls him, he's nicknamed him Mr. Switzerland because Priebus is sort of Trump's chief emissary to Republican skeptics who still need to be won over to support Trump's candidacy. That's sort of Priebus's role now. And I think Trump also realizes, he's a guy who got to where he is essentially by seizing the media spotlight. Trump didn't build a big campaign organization. He doesn't have a big data operation. He doesn't even have very many field staffers. And so he is going to need to depend on the Republican National Committee, Priebus's money and staff, in order to kind of build that out if he wants to have a fighting chance in the fall. So it's a sort of a shotgun wedding, I describe it as. But the two are now connected. Trump is reliant on Priebus, but is certainly the guy in charge and calling the shots.
What about the money situation? We've heard that Clinton will have $1 billion. Does Trump need $1 billion or a bit more to become elected? And does he have access to that money? What does he think? What does Priebus think?
Well, he certainly doesn't think that he needs that money. But, you know, if you talk to campaign experts, they essentially say, you know, this is going to be a campaign. To run a competitive campaign, you're going to need to spend between $1 billion and $2 billion. That is awfully difficult for a guy like Trump. You know, Mitt Romney had been running for president for years, had a vast financial network, all sorts of rich people he could tap into. Trump is a novice politician. He doesn't have that network, and he said repeatedly that he's not inclined to spend all of his own money in a general election. So he's probably not going to be able to raise that much. Now, he and the RNC have teamed up, and there are some Republican financial people that are going to help Trump raise money. But while the public line has been, oh, yes, you know, we Republicans are going to raise $1 billion, $2 billion, Trump told me, you know, he's probably only going to raise about $500 million. And then he sort of scoffed and said, I don't see why you need all that money anyway. You know, we've got basically 4 months until election, and, you know, anytime I want, I can fly my plane to whatever state and seize all the media attention. And
yes,
he's got a point. He can't seize the attention. The question is, can you win a national campaign that way against a candidate who will be very well-funded and have all the latest technology and turnout operation, which Hillary Clinton will be expected to have?
Well, somebody made an estimate, and I think it's valid, that he got $2 billion worth of free publicity just by the amount of cable news exposure he got during the primaries. He got a lot of airplay.
Well, he did, and it worked great in the primaries when it was Trump against, you know, 16 other candidates. But the problem Trump has now, or the challenge he faces, is, you know, you can't pay for campaign staffers in, you know, sound bites and speeches. You have to pay them in hard dollars. If you want to run TV ads, you know, you have to raise and spend money to be able to do that. So while Trump can certainly get himself on, you know, CNN anytime he wants, it's not clear that that translates into a robust turnout operation that is going to seek out, you know, identify and get all of his possible voters to the poll. The poll will ever form on election day.
Yeah. In 2011, you write about Trump starting this birther, ridiculous birther idea. And I'm wondering how complicit Priebus and others were in getting a Trump candidacy because they didn't denounce him. That Priebus had to field awkward questions about Trump's birther antics, you write, but he never denounced Trump, and Trump never recanted.
Well, this is one of the problems. I mean, people wonder how it is that the Republican Party has gone so far off the rails. I think one of the reasons why is that when you had stuff like the birther craze in 2011, 2012, Republican officials, for the most part, were uncomfortable criticizing directly the people who believed that sort of thing because they were worried that, hey, you know, these are Republican voters. We need their support. We don't want to repel them. So instead of denouncing Trump and saying, this is absurd, you should stop saying this, they said, well, you know, Priebus had said, well, you know, I myself don't believe this, but, you know, there's right. room for all sorts of views within the party, and essentially functioned as Trump enablers.
Mm-hmm. What was Trump's response when you asked him what the Republican Party would look like in 5 years?
Well, this is a question that is sort of causing a lot of angst among conservative intellectuals. The idea that a figure like Trump, who doesn't care a whit about conservative policies, and in fact has said all sorts of things that true conservatives find wildly offensive, could nonetheless capture the nomination of their party. And what Trump has done that's so interesting is he has broken with conservative orthodoxy all sorts of ways. You know, rather than cut entitlements like Medicare and Social Security, you know, he wants to maintain them. Rather than invade Middle East countries, Trump wants to stay out of those sorts of wars. He's even defended the work of Planned Parenthood and other groups that are typically demonized by conservative Republicans. And he's done all that and still gotten elected. I asked Trump, I said, you know, gee, you have violated all these orthodoxies and yet proved wildly popular within the Republican universe. How do you expect that your nomination and perhaps your presidency will change the direction of the party? And what Trump told me was that he envisioned refashioning the Republican Party as a workers' party.
Fascinating.
I don't know if he was intentionally or unintentionally borrowing from communist language, but he said he wanted it to be a workers' party that would give people higher wages, that would not cut their benefits, that would have more of a populist, nationalist bent to it. And also, I think that was very hostile to open borders and immigration, which is another area where prominent conservatives like Paul Ryan of Wisconsin tend to break with Trump. They want to have free trade. Mm-hmm. They want to have robust immigration. Trump wants neither of those things. So the fact that he is now taking control of the party could really change the GOP's identity going forward.
And you have to be really careful when you talk about cutting Social Security or privatizing Social Security, don't you?
You do, and I have a scene in the piece, actually. You know, Trump had a famous meeting with Paul Ryan and Reince Priebus in Washington on May 12th. It was supposed to be a kind of a chance for a detente and a chance to win over Ryan, who had held out from endorsing Trump. And a source in that meeting told me essentially that Trump dressed down Paul Ryan and said, you know, not only is it morally wrong to cut people's Social Security benefits like you want to do, Paul, but it's politically stupid that a Republican would run and try and get elected on taking away people's benefits against the Democratic nominee who's going to want to increase them. And I thought that was a very revealing episode of how Trump could potentially change the Republican Party in a way that would give heartburn to a lot of conservatives who don't want to do those things.
And an amazing thing showing a lack of self-introspection when he talks to somebody about what you've done is morally wrong. Have you not looked at yourself, perhaps, Mr. Trump?
I'll let that one float. But but I think, you know, I actually credit Trump with having really offered up an analysis of what was lacking in Republican politics that nobody else saw or wanted to see. I mean, I think Trump understood intuitively that the idea of running for the Republican nomination, promising a hawkish foreign policy, tax cuts for rich people, was maybe not all that appealing to ordinary working class folks who hadn't had a raise in a long time and who didn't want to lose their government benefits. And, you know, to his credit, he stood up for that. He articulated and defended that policy, and it turned out that Republican voters liked what he had to say. So I actually credit Trump on that front more than I would a Paul Ryan. I mean, Ryan's ideas were pretty soundly defeated in the Republican primary this year, and I think that tells us a lot about what is lacking in the Republican platform before Trump came along.
It is amazing. You have these three gentlemen from Wisconsin, Reince Priebus and Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, who have really risen to the top at their games, haven't they?
Well, they have, and one of the interesting things is the effect that Wisconsin Republican politics has had on the U.S. nationally. I mean, these were three guys. You know, one of the reasons that Priebus was elected RNC chairman was people saw what he'd done as Wisconsin Republican Party chairman, the way that the Republican Party had come in and essentially taken over the state and produced, you know, these budding young Republican stars or people who are believed to be stars in Paul Ryan, the future House Speaker, and Scott Walker, who I think even back then was viewed as a blue chip presidential candidate. You can see the appeal from a national Republican standpoint. You know, here is a state that has often voted Democratic in presidential elections, you know, purple state at best, and these young Republicans were able to kind of come in and take over. Wouldn't it be great if we could import that kind of talent into the national party and do the same thing at the national level? And the problem is that along comes Trump like a wrecking ball and sort of destroys everything these guys had hoped to build.
Yeah. Well, let's welcome phone calls for you. Joshua Green is our first guest this hour, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. He's written a very interesting, well-documented piece that includes interviews, long interviews with Reince Priebus and also Donald Trump. How to get Trump elected when he's wrecking everything you built. A day in the life of Reince Priebus, reluctant GOP peacemaker. It's in Bloomberg Business Week. Our phone number, we have some lines open for you right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, where we have posted this article, in case you haven't had a chance to read it, it's well worth reading. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we have a ton of phone calls coming in. Let's go to Carol in Green Bay first. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi, Carol.
You know, I am thinking back to 2012 when Mitt Romney lost, and I think it was Bobby Jindal who came out. I mean, it was the GOP looking at themselves at that point and thinking, something's wrong here. It looks like our party is down to, as they put it, all these old white guys. And so then Bobby Jindal comes along and said in a speech, we have to stop being the party of stupid. And here we are again. You know, and then there's stuff like yesterday with Trump. And I think to myself, if he is that thin-skinned, you know, I mean, he has to lose. But I think his supporters eat up stuff like yesterday. Oh, that's the thing. That's all I have.
Thanks, Carol. Josh.
Well, I think that's right. His supporters do eat it up. The question, though, is whether those supporters compose an electoral majority. And at least right now, it doesn't look like they do. The challenge that led people like Jindal to say, you know, we can't be the stupid party anymore, was really a demographic challenge I talked about earlier, that the trends in American demographics were moving against the Republican Party, and that rather than being stupid, they had to be smart about how they were going to attract those voters, most of them non-white and younger. And the problem they seem to have, at least if you look at Trump's popularity among those groups, is that he is deeply, deeply unpopular. So that doesn't mean that he can't win or that there isn't a path to victory, but it means it's a very, very narrow path. And rather than choosing a more moderate candidate who might hold more appeal to these groups, they've chosen someone whose whole political identity essentially is geared toward alienating those very people and intensifying the support of the older white people who make up the core of the Republican Party right now.
Peter is next in Baraboo. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you so much. I appreciate the conversation. I think demographics played a tremendous role in, as your guest has indicated. What that demographics described, however, was certain means that needed to be used in order to be successful. And it is those means that have corrupted government in Wisconsin, and those means are the means which have been utilized on the National Republican Party. And that includes voter ID, it includes gerrymandering, it includes all of the negative aspects that one could ever imagine. And that is why Wisconsin state government was taken over. And that is the reality that we're facing today. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
You know, I think that's a good point. I mean, the fundamental challenge that I see the Republican Party having, and I got at this in the piece a little bit, is that after 2012, they looked at how do we want to, you know, we're clear that we need to attract these non-white voters. You know, we're going to try and present a more moderate, happy face. But what they fundamentally didn't do was change a lot of these policies. I mean, essentially, the Republican idea was if we can just come up with a more friendly or compelling sales pitch for the same old ideas, we'll be able to win these people over. And I think the problem which your caller gets at is that there are a lot of these policies, and we'll take the one he mentioned, voter ID. These laws essentially purport to solve a problem that doesn't really exist, the idea that people are fraudulently voting in mass numbers and swinging elections. And when you put in these stricter laws requiring people to have, you know, driver's licenses and photo IDs, what studies show that tends to do is to disenfranchise poor black elderly voters. A lot of Republicans across the country in various states have been caught on camera saying things like, gee, if we just pass these voter ID laws, it'll make it harder for Democrats to get elected. And so it leaves the Republican Party on the one hand saying, well, we need to attract these non-white voters, while on the other hand espousing policies like voter ID laws that are specifically geared to prevent them from voting. I mean, it sends a mixed message that I don't think is particularly helpful in accomplishing what Republicans want to accomplish, which is to appeal to a wider swath of voters. And I think Trump coming along only intensifies that problem for them.
When you talked about with Priebus about Trump's tone and some of what he said, which is pretty sensational, you quote him as saying, we're going to have a nominee who's going to pivot in tone and tenor. He understands that. Really?
Well, I think this was more Priebus kind of speaking out loud to try and convince himself. I don't think he really convinced me or a lot of other people. But Republican leaders who understand Trump's power and understand the fact that he was going to be their nominee have been saying all along, gee, you know, he's going to pivot. Any one of these days, he's going to kind of shake off this wild man persona and adopt a more presidential, scholarly mane, what have you. And it keeps not happening. Every time he comes out to a press conference, you know, Trump is Trump. That's what he does. That's who he is. That's what his supporters love. But there's still a hope, a fleeting hope, I think, but a hope among Republican officials like Priebus that Trump eventually will kind of settle down and behave more like a traditional nominee, meaning one who doesn't go out of his way to alienate people like Susana Martinez, the Republican Hispanic governor in New Mexico Trump insulted the other day, or kind of, you know, going after the media, which probably doesn't cost him too much of an electoral price, but is nonetheless regarded as unpresidential behavior. I think the Trump you see is the Trump you get, but there's still a hope among Republicans that he'll settle down and be more presidential.
And Jim in Rice Lake, hi.
Hi, thank you. And I have two quick questions for your guests. First one is, Nate Silver from 538.com has predicted accurately the entire electoral map in the last two elections. He gives Trump about a 25% chance of winning based on the structural and economic reasons your guests have talked about, or the problems. I want to know your guests' opinion of that projection, too. Does your guest, I've never met Donald Trump, does he think he has the ability, so to speak, to stay on message or point during the campaign, or does he predict that we'll see him throw a grenade down his own throat at some point? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jim.
What a colorful image, the grenade down the throat.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Nate Silver. I am not I'm a magazine reporter. I'm not a political prognosticator, so I don't offer predictions. But I think Nate's sounds pretty reasonable to me. Nate had also gone back and done sort of his own personal autopsy on why he failed to see Trump's rise and why he was skeptical about it. But I think everybody agrees that there is certainly a distinct non-zero chance that Trump could win the presidency. As far as whether or not Trump can stay on message, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things I think that helped him win the Republican nomination was that he did stick to this Trumpian message of, you know, we're going to make America great again, politicians are losers and corrupt. You know, you knew what he stood for in a way that maybe you didn't know what Scott Walker stood for or Bobby Jindal stood for, any of the other guys up there on stage. So he can certainly drive a message. He's got that talent, sort of Trump the pitchman. The problem is he doesn't seem to be able to avoid the personal attacks and insults that he delights in launching and kind of revels in and get all the cable media attention. And it's hard for me to envision him winning an election doing two things at once. On the one hand, sort of driving this message that, hey, we need to make America great again, and here are my ideas for doing this, while at the same time distracting from that message by attacking people left and right. So if I were betting, I guess I'd lean a little bit more toward the grenade down the throat, as the caller put it. But one thing we've seen from Trump again and again is that he is a surprisingly effective politician who somehow is able to intuit what it is that will move voters in a way that many professional politicians cannot. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you ever want to undersell that talent.
Mm. Josh, thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for writing the article. It's really very good.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
I guess this half hour, Joshua Green, senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, senior editor at The Atlantic. He was before that. He's written for The New Yorker, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. Switching to the Democratic side now, media outlets, our guest this half hour, it wrote, are reporting some grumbling about Debbie Wasserman Schultz's leadership of the Democratic National Committee and whether she can bring the party back together after a divisive presidential primary. So we're going to be talking about her and the challenges to her. And our guest now is Alex Rorty. He's senior political writer for Roll Call, worked previously at the National Journal, where he served as chief political correspondent for the Hotline. We'll be welcoming phone calls now on this side of the aisle, the Democrats, and what ails them when it comes to leadership leadership. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at Kay Dunn Show. Alex, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
So how serious is this challenge to her leadership of the DNC? Have there been a lot of people signing petitions?
You know, there is a lot of dissension in the Democratic Party, and it's kind of from all corners of it. I mean, you have a lot of the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, a lot of liberal activists who are unhappy with her stewardship of the DNC, related in a lot of ways because they see her as in the tank for Hillary Clinton, particularly the way she arranged all the debates earlier on in the primary. But you also have some anger with more establishment-oriented Democrats, in particular from the White House. I mean, there have been recent stories about Democrats thinking of, you know, challenging her leadership of the DNC. But this is actually nothing new. This dates back years, actually, and a lot of other reporting stipulating that Obama and his brain trust were unhappy with her leadership, didn't think that she was doing a good job running the DNC while being too focused on her own personal political career. And so it's put her in a very difficult position. I will say she, in this case, has time on her side. The convention is this summer, of course. She is, of course, running the convention as the chairwoman of the DNC. The idea of switching that now with just, you know, weeks before the convention strikes some Democrats as highly unlikely, as dissatisfied as they might be with Debbie Wasserman.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk first about the problems that she's facing, the lack of happiness with her chairmanship from the people who are in the Sanders campaign. Is it legitimate? Do they have legitimate grievances against her?
You know, the number of debates and the way the debates were handled, I think there is some room for a legitimate disagreement. You remember, there were, you know, at one point there were only going to be six debates. When we started debating last year, there were so many fewer of those than there were on the Republican side. And a lot of the Democratic debates, of course, were on Saturday night, not exactly a prime time for television watching. Now, DNC officials and Debbie Wasserman Schultz have said that they, you know, wanted to give everyone a chance to watch this. You know, they didn't have to get up to go to work in the next morning. They wanted a chance to be on network TV, unlike, you know, CNN or another cable outlet. So that's the reason. But there was a lot of anger about that. You know, other than the debates, It's less clear how much Debbie Wasserman Schultz is at fault here. You know, Democrats a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters have been unhappy over some of the caucus processes and some of the process of accrediting delegates, most notably in Nevada weeks ago, where there was a big tussle up, and a lot of Democrats on both sides were unhappy about the result of that. It's not clear to me where Debbie Wasserman Schultz comes into that. But, you know, as can often happen in a situation like this, you know, whether she's responsible or not, she becomes the face of opposition to a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who just use her as kind of a catch-all for their gripes about the larger system and the way the primary has gone. Mm.
She didn't gain any Sanders supporters, though, with her comments. I saw her on television the night when they were reporting about the commotion at the Nevada State Convention, and she really took Sanders to support for being at the top of this, and he didn't forcefully enough condemn the actions of his supporters. She was mad at him.
She was, and she wasn't the only Democrat. Harry Reid, of course, Bernie Sanders' colleague in the Senate and the Senate Minority Leader, also really taking Sanders to task. Of course, he's also from Nevada. I think her comments at that point particularly reflect the frustration that, it can feel like Bernie Sanders isn't only not winding his campaign down. In some ways, it feels like he's escalating things. Just when you look at the math, his chances of success are you know, next to nil, almost. And in fact, next week, most people predict that after the New Jersey primary, Hillary Clinton will actually clinch the Democratic nomination. And so there is a lot of frustration with that. And they look, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, if you're the DNC chairwoman, You know, your number one job is to elect a Democratic president this year. And Donald Trump has secured the Republican nomination. His polling all of a sudden looks much better than it did even a few months ago. And you start to become a little more anxious. You start to become a little more worried about your chances all of a sudden. And that can explain why she took the shots that she did at Bernie Sanders and his supporters.
And yet at the same time, she is also responsible partially for bringing those millions of Bernie Sanders supporters into the fold and voting for Hillary Clinton. Can you do that with the way that she has treated those supporters? She's not very welcoming to them.
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent point. And she is going to be in a very difficult position. And this is a good time to mention, she has her own primary challenge.
Yes, right.
You know, Florida's House and Senate primaries are on a different schedule than the presidential primary. And, you know, it takes place August 30th, so you have several months. She is running against a challenger who has actually been endorsed by Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has sent a fundraising letter on his behalf. So she has her own not just, you know, personal political problems, but maybe all the more reason to be angry with Bernie Sanders right now. You know, look, I think the short answer to this is it's not going to be Debbie Wasserman Schultz who is the one who is bringing Bernie Sanders supporters back into the fold.
Right.
I think that is going to fall to Elizabeth Warren. Mm. I think it's going to fall to President Obama. And, of course, most of all, it's going to fall to Hillary Clinton. It is difficult, like you point out, to imagine Debbie Wasserman Schultz leading this effort to try to get the Bernie Sanders supporters back on her side when there's already so much tension between the two sides.
Mm-hmm. Alex, how did she become head of the DNC?
Well, there was a thought, you know, President Obama running for his own reelection as president, that, you know, look, at the time, it's hard to remember now, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was seen as a rising star in the Democratic Party. You know, she was telegenic, she was smart, she knew policy, she knew the politics. And, you know, according to a lot of reporting around the time, you know, Barack Obama didn't have a lot of women in his leadership at that point in his campaign. And you know, they needed a visible, prominent woman who knew politics, knew policy, to run the DNC and to help his own campaign. You know, the pick was widely celebrated at the time by a lot of Democrats. It's just that since she took over, a lot of these questions have risen to the point where, you know, we're talking about a fairly dramatic, potentially a what would be a dramatic change in DNC leadership just a few months before the convention and 6 months before the actual election.
Mm. So you don't think that's going to happen?
I'm skeptical. I think what you see are a lot of Democrats who are unhappy with her. But the logistics of doing this is difficult. And look, to be perfectly honest, the DNC is, of course, an important position. But it just isn't maybe as important as you would assume or think, or even as important as the RNC is on the GOP side. Hillary Clinton's campaign is going to be running the show. It's, of course, better to have a fully operational DNC at the same time. But you have to look at what Barack Obama has done to taking office. It almost feels like he ignores the DNC most of the time. He has his own political network. He had Obama for America and Organizing for America that he set up mm-hmm. even after taking office. The DNC has been really relegated to a JV role. And so for all the drama at the top here, it's unclear what the real general election consequence of all this is going to be mm-hmm. for Democrats.
Well, let's welcome phone calls. Alex Rorty is our guest this half hour, senior political writer for Roll Call. We're talking about the grumbling about Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who also is facing a primary challenge, her leadership of the Democratic National Committee, whether she can bring the party together again after this presidential primary, which is still ongoing. What do you think? Can she do that? Is it time for the DNC to have another head? Or is it, as Alex has said, not as important to the Democrats as it is to the Republicans? Here's our phone number. Time for you to make a call if you'd like to talk about all of this. 800-486-8255. 8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, our Facebook page, where we like to have you like us because then you'll get notifications about upcoming shows. And it's a great site because a lot of these articles that we're talking about are posted there, so you can get this great political, cultural perusal of articles and thoughts and ideas from other listeners, too. So that's the all of that is to promote liking us on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Alex Rorty. And our first caller is Aaron in Manitowoc. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Doing well on my way to work. Just was listening into your conversation regarding the DNC and the presumptive nomination of Hillary Clinton. And as a Bernie supporter, I feel like the contested primary elections, most notably New Mexico, I think that was one, Nevada and New York, that from my point of view, it feels like Hillary stole the election. Do you and your guests believe that is a relatively common sentiment? And if not, why?
And let me ask you, Aaron, if Bernie Sanders is not the nominee, are you going to support and vote for Hillary Clinton?
I will, just because I don't feel I could support Donald Trump.
Okay.
Alex? That's interesting. Now, look, I think among Bernie Sanders supporters, there is a sense that the some of the primaries have been stolen from him. And even, I think, from my own observations, if Bernie Sanders isn't outright stoking that sense, he's not dismissing it either among his supporters. What I would say to that, though, is, you know, the caller had mentioned the Nevada caucuses and the sense that they have been cheated there. The frustration among some Democrats and some neutral political observers, frankly, under the idea that this was stolen from Bernie Sanders, was Hillary Clinton won Nevada. If people remember, it was a major showdown after the Iowa and New Hampshire races, the caucuses and primaries there. And she won it narrowly by about 5 points, but she did win it. So there is some confusion about then why did the subsequent delegate selection process, why did Bernie Sanders supporters think they were entitled to have more delegates than Hillary Clinton? So that is the frustration there. But to the caller's point, yes, I do think that's a widespread sense among a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters right now.
And what's your sense of whether or not they are going to vote for Hillary Clinton enthusiastically? Do you think that's going to happen?
Enthusiastically, no. I don't think that. But as the caller mentioned, you know, Democrats and Hillary Clinton's campaign will have a powerful motivator to get the Bernie Sanders supporters to at least vote for her, whether enthusiastic or not, and that's Donald Trump. He is going to spur a lot of liberals and a lot of progressives to vote for Hillary, not out of because they like her especially, but just out of a concern for Trump himself.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Joan in Eau Claire. Hi, Joan.
Good afternoon. My comment is this. If voters feel that a man of humble beginning, who is honest as day is long, as our days are long, cannot rise to the highest office in our land and clearly the world, if someone in the DNC is trying to impede that process, then I think that citizens will surely feel rebellious toward that. And to be honest with you, I do not blame them. And while we're on the topic, I think that many of us perhaps think that the Electoral College should be over and done with. And thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Sure. Absolutely. Thanks for your call.
You know, interestingly, there's actually a movement to effectively do away with the Electoral College, where states will pass laws that pledge their Electoral College votes to whoever wins the national popular vote. Now, this is a movement that's gotten some attention. It's been going on for years right now. No sense that it's on the precipice of actually happening just yet, but this isn't a new frustration with the Electoral College, you know, for a lot of people, particularly Democrats, after the 2000 presidential race, when Al Gore, of course, won the presidential vote, but presidential popular vote but lost the Electoral College. So the caller's point, that this is not a new frustration, but there is a solution out there right now from some people.
There is, along Jones' theme here, there is something about the media, the press, sort of disdainful of Bernie Sanders. What Bernie Sanders has done is pretty remarkable when you think about it. He has millions of voters. He's won a number of states. He's a Democratic socialist, for heaven's sake.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, what he has done is quite remarkable. And he hasn't received, maybe it's because of Donald Trump, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But he hasn't received the recognition for that. Do you think he has? I don't think he has.
Well, I think there are two things going on. One, to your point, you know, what Bernie Sanders has done has, in a lot of ways, been historic. It's been remarkable that he is, you know, we're sitting here on June 1st, and the race is still ongoing. Nobody would have predicted that. Frankly, I wouldn't have predicted that even 6 months ago. You know, so, and there have been assessments and analysis done that, you know, as far as no, you know, quote-unquote insurgent candidate or whichever candidate is not backed by the so-called establishment, has done as well and has gone as far as Bernie Sanders, with the exception, of course, of Barack Obama in 2008. What he has done has been remarkable. And what it says about the Democratic Party and where the Democratic Party is headed is incredibly important. It's an incredibly important story. That said, there's a second part to this that I think is separate. And these things are not, you know, you can, both of these things can be true at one time. What Bernie Sanders has done is remarkable, and at the same time, he really has never been that much of a threat to actually win the Democratic nomination. For as many millions of votes as he's won, he's never been able to break through with non-white voters. And the simple truth is, in the Democratic Party in 2016, you have to be able to appeal to more than just white voters to have a winning coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that second part is where some of the frustration comes from some political analysts, that there's been a lot made about, you know, that Bernie Sanders still has a chance, that he could still win this, that the comeback is possible, again, stoked by Bernie himself, when in their own objective analysis, they just don't think that the numbers are there for him. And, you know, one interesting example of this, you know, and I talked to Bernie Sanders supporters at a rally in Baltimore not long ago, and I asked them, you know, was there ever a point where you really thought, you know, the senator could really win this? And they all mentioned Michigan, when he won the Michigan primary unexpectedly, a big surprise,
yes,
in March, and everyone said, oh, you know, that was the moment I had hope. Look, I understand that it was a huge surprise. It was a great victory for Bernie Sanders. On the very same night, Hillary Clinton won an enormous victory in the Mississippi primary and actually won more delegates that night than Bernie Sanders did. I think that is maybe where the disconnect comes sometimes. But to go back to your point, I'm not sure the media has fully grappled with what the success of the Bernie Sanders campaign, whether or not he can win, the success of the Bernie Sanders' campaign means for the future of the Democratic Party. But I think it's something that all of us in the media are going to be grappling with for years to come, mm-hmm, after this primary ends.
Yeah, well, obviously all those young voters, too. Well,
absolutely.
And this thought lingers, too. Just quickly respond to this in email. The polls show Sanders is far stronger than Clinton in defeating Trump. He's also far superior on labor, environment, election reform, foreign policy. He's obviously a Sanders supporter. Clinton is a terrible candidate. The superdelegates should favor Sanders if their mission is to make sure the party prevails in November.
It's a very fair point. And what I would say to this is, Hillary Clinton is a deeply unpopular candidate right now, and she is a very weak general election candidate, and that shows up in polling. And when you have conversations, even with Democratic strategists who hope with all their heart that Hillary Clinton wins, their clear-eyed assessment is that she is a weak candidate. All of that said, she has been the focus of unrelenting attacks most of her political career, that stretches now practically 30 years. The idea that she can get much worse at this point, or that they're going to use something new against her, just isn't true. Bernie Sanders has not been subject to that kind of criticism. And the concern among some Democrats is, look, he is stronger in head-to-head matchups and polls right now, but what happens after Republicans spend the summer dissecting his record, launching negative attacks, doing the kinds of things they've already been doing against Hillary Clinton? is that going to weaken him? Now, maybe it won't. Maybe it won't. I think you have to acknowledge that it's possible that even after all that, Bernie Sanders remains a stronger candidate than Hillary Clinton, whether he has some kind of unique strength that we're not accounting for, or that she really is just that weak a candidate. But it is a big risk, again, for a 70-something socialist from Vermont. There are vulnerabilities there. Mm-hmm. With that Republicans could exploit.
Thanks, Alex, so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Alex Rorty, senior political writer for Roll Call, both our guests this hour. I hope we'll return. Joshua Green, we thank also. Senior national correspondent for Bloomberg Business Week. Many thanks to KP Whaley for producing this highly interesting hour. To Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls on this. We have posted articles on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, that are worth reading after you've listened to this show because they're excellent. Back after the news.